just delighted to be sitting here and get a chance to pick your brain. We're going to get a little more focused on Saturday night. You're playing pieces here that are some by guitar players, some are by keyboardists.
Mm-hmm.
And the transcription that's on here is by Couperin.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
How long ago did you do this?
This one's maybe 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I made this transcription. But I started doing some Couperin, and I did a few select little pieces, and they worked really well because a lot of his music is relatively sparse, you know, and he relies more on the ornamentation, and the excitement comes from other places. And perhaps also because he was writing a lot of his music as kind of lessons for his pupils. Luckily, he had some very good pupils. And he usually collected his pieces into suites, which he called orders. So I really wanted to be able to have one whole suite, as opposed to taking one in this key, one in that key, and sticking them together and just making like five pieces by Couperin. So finally, on this one is actually the complete suite. And, you know, it works very well. And on the guitar, we hardly have to change a single note. The only problem is how to get the ornamentation to, resemble what the harpsichordists can do. And of course, they can do their trills and turns and things. It's so much simpler for them. For us, it's a bit more difficult. So I had to change some of those and choose the ones that work well on the guitar.
Scarlatti, you've also made transcription here of the couple of sonatas that you'd be playing.
Yeah.
You think about taking your hands from this position to this. I'd love to talk to pianists about, you can tell me what kind of a pianist Brahms was, having played Brahms, and they're usually like breakers. They're so complicated.
Okay.
They don't sound that tough, but they're just, you know, Beethoven lays well. He was a great piano player and wanted to write things to people. When you go to work on some of these keyboard pieces from the Baroque, mm-hmm. I guess first you are dealing with something that was plucked, so that's a heads up, right?
Yeah. Except, I mean, that's a heads up in terms of sound. Mm. In terms of, you know, they're playing an instrument where the note is start strong and then dies away, which is exactly what ours does, you know, as opposed to, say, a flute or a violin, which creates the note continually. So musically, we're very close to the harpsichord, if you like. But physically, it's completely different. You know, with the guitar or our instruments, like the lute, etc., basically you need two fingers to make one note, you know, whereas they're playing an instrument that one finger is enough.
Yeah.
So the ergonomics is just, it just works much better on the keyboard, obviously. And on the guitar, you're fighting with these other things. But there's another thing, really. It's the musical pleasure or joy of playing that kind of music that draws me towards making the transcriptions. I mean, we have a huge amount of repertoire written by guitarists or by people who understood the guitar very well, that in some ways makes the guitar work comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you said, say, Beethoven sits in the finger. Well, Giuliani, who's the guy at the first, I mean, that guy obviously, we can tell that he had fantastic arpeggios because he fills his music with arpeggios. And they're, if you can play fast, they're really quite comfortable. You know, even if they're flashy and sometimes difficult, but they're comfortable.
But you had a great player writing so that another great player can come along and say, I know what you're, I get
this. Absolutely. You can understand what he was about and what he liked to do with his music.
When I first heard the Assad Brothers, and it just, my jaw dropped on the ground, this really driving, passionate kind of music that was so in sync.
Yes.
Well, Sergio's written more than one thing for you, right?
Yes. You know, they're great, great players, great musicians, and great friends. You know, we've been friends for a long time, both Odair and Sergio. And Sergio wrote a fantastic piece called Aquarelle. It's a three-movement sonata. And I played that. I've recorded it as well. And many other people now have done it. It's just a wonderful piece. And he's written a couple of pieces that we call portraits for me. I've recorded and or played. And this last one, Sandy's portrait, is a piece really... This man, Sandy Bolton, had helped many, many guitarists. He was very wealthy, and he left a lot of money to the guitar world, if you like. And he was still alive, and we said, we want to give Sandy a present, you know. And so we phoned up Sergio, and he started writing straight away. And unfortunately, Sandy didn't hear the piece. He died before we could play it for him. But I've kept it in repertoire for a year and a half now, and I love the piece. It's a fabulous piece, and you know, it's nice that I get to think of Sandy almost every day when I practice the piece. And I also think of Sergio, my friend, as well. So it's a great piece for me to play.
You'll close out tonight with some, appropriately enough, some Celtic pieces.
That's right.
Do you know what you're going to play? Because it just says Celtic pieces.
Yes. Well,
you know, you got just this stash, you can pull out what you want to do that night.
Well, I now know what I'm going to play. But when I was sending in the program, you know, sometimes you send a program 6 months or 8 months in advance. It's so I wasn't sure which of the ones I've done. You know, I have a whole CD I made of music like that. And I wanted to be able to choose and not be restricted just to, say, the three that I chose. So, but now on the tour, I've chosen the three that I'm going to play. That actually, they are Irish, the three ones, although I'm Scottish.
Okay.
But I have some Scottish pieces and some Irish ones, and maybe I'll play a Scottish one in the middle. But it gives me the freedom to, you know, to change something if I want.
It's nice that you can do the Irish bit and not have an internal struggle going on.
Oh, no. Well, Scotland and Ireland are very close, you know.
Okay. All right. David Russell, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure being here.
Yeah, I see I have my camera here, so you've got a groupie in the room.
I am a camera fan as well. You know, I love taking photographs.
You're one of those guitar players that all guitarists love. And I've been telling everyone to go to your webpage because of the great parts you have on your site about how to do this, and there's no substitute for practice. And when you're
oh, really? Okay.
How did that grow, your website? Was it just...
Originally, some friends some years ago said, hey, you've got no web page, you've got to do one, right? And a guitarist friend who is really good at computer stuff, he just made one for us.
Okay.
And it started like that. And slowly, as the years have gone by, we've learned to put things on it. I mean, now it can all stay in the cloud and things. So we can do it from wherever we are, hotel room or anything. Yeah. And slowly, really, it's grown from being just a little bit of information and some press photos and things into everything else. You know?
It's really nice that, I have to ask, too, there are so many pieces, on that page particularly, there are pieces of art, there are little sketches. And
yeah.
Who's doing those?
Some of them are mine.
Are they? Okay.
There's one that's a drawing of my father's that he made of me while I was practicing.
Okay.
And I used that as, I think, maybe a kind of comment about concentration and... You know, but most of the drawings are mine.
Yeah. There's something more collegial about the guitar, I think, than any other instrument. I mean, pianists are colleagues, violinists,
yes,
violists, but guitar is like a brotherhood because you're always defending the fact that this is my instrument, unless you're you and you play as well as you do.
I mean, no, we all need to help each other. You know, it's I think because the guitar, it has a very wide range of taste in the audience. You know, we often have jazzers will come to our concerts, or folk people or things, and also dyed-in-the-wool classical people, you know. So we do draw from many places, but for a long time we've been slightly out of the mainstream classical. So I think, you know, if something doesn't work very well for one classical player, one classical guitarist, it actually hurts us all. And if someone does really well and has big success in their New York concert or whatever, it's actually good for all of us. Whereas, you know, with the pianists, that's not really the case. You know, it's almost the opposite.
Yeah.
The only other group that I know that are so close-knit and friendly are the viola players. You know, perhaps because they don't really have a kind of competition amongst themselves so much. You know, they all help each other. But the guitarists, right enough, it's a very, very friendly group.
When it's almost like when you get to a place as a player, when you get to a certain stature, and some even not, part of your job is to make sure there's more repertoire, expand the repertoire, have music composed for your instruments, that's done for
that's
you
right.
pretty regularly,
yeah.
And then transcriptions, which we'll be hearing, I think, one of your transcriptions Saturday night, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, I always transcribe pieces. You know, some people would say, well, why play something by Bach if he never wrote for the guitar? Well, I think it would be really sad to spend your whole life and not play anything by Bach, even if it's just for purely selfish reasons. So I've made transcriptions since I started. And, you know, it expands the repertoire for others, but the original reason was really for myself. And then if I do a good transcription, if I make something that is really worth it, of course, I'll publish them and other people can play them.
Let's go back to your roots, because my understanding is you're born in Glasgow, and then you end up on an island that's part of Spain.
Yes, right. Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, my parents are artists. They're painters. And, you know, they'd studied in art school and everything. And then my father was teaching art in a primary school in the west coast of Scotland. You know, it wasn't the most satisfying for him. He felt that he really wanted to use what he had learnt, and my mum as well. So at that time, I think we were three children, and I was really quite young. So basically, we just piled into a van and went through France, and after some weeks, we arrived in Barcelona. They had already travelled before, or we had. I don't remember. I was three or something. So that time, I was about six, and they arrived to Barcelona, and some friends had been to Ibiza. Ibiza is one of the islands off the east coast of Spain, and Ibiza was famous as an artist colony, and it became famous later as a hippie colony, that was some years later. But originally, they wanted to go there, but we lived in this rather large van at that time, and the crane couldn't lift, the Ibiza boat crane wouldn't lift our van, but there was a ramp that went to the Menorca boat, so we could drive on there. So my parents said, well, let's go to Menorca. And so we ended up on that island. And then we lived there for 6 months. And then some years later, you know, it became our home.
So it wasn't, you weren't chasing the light so much as just, where can I get the van?
Well, partly, yes. But still, they were chasing exactly, as you said, the light, because mm-hmm. they felt that, you know, they had learned, they loved Van Gogh, etc. They loved the post-impressionists, which is basically all light, the paintings. And my parents' paintings has a lot of that in their style, if you like. And they wanted to live somewhere where the brilliant sunshine is a part of everyday life, like here.
If we are spoiled that way.
Absolutely.
In the first of all, it's always nice to sit with someone who's actually in the Grove Dictionary. You know.
Oh, really? I didn't know I was there.
You are. You're there. But in the words in the Grove, effectively, I have the article. You can just take it with you. It says you studied with your father. Were you learning together, or did he play?
Well, he plays, but he's an amateur, and he doesn't play particularly well. And he played a little bit of jazz. He loved Django Reinhardt and things. He loved flamenco and classical. So really, he taught me how to read, but very laboriously. I mean, both of us were, when I was really, really young, I didn't read music very well at all, because I didn't have the right kind of training, if you like. My father just did what he could. And the same with technique. You know, he'd kind of look at Segovia's picture and say, well, his right hand is like this, so let's try and do that. And then when I was about 14 or so, I got more help mm-hmm. from people who had proper training, if you like.
Okay, so he liked, you know, the world's greatest three-finger guitar player and jazz players and
that's
other
right.
things. What were you drawn to? Were you always drawn to classical? Was there a time, because you talked to some very great classical guitarists, and they started playing electric guitar in a band somewhere,
yeah,
and then found a nylon string guitar, and that was it.
I think especially players from this country have come through, say, playing folk or playing in a band, as you say. But in Europe, mostly people go straight into classical, you know, or straight into flamenco, for example. And it doesn't really happen that, you know, for example, if a classical pianist doesn't actually play Beethoven until they're 18, they don't have a chance.
Right.
You know, really. And in some ways, in classical guitar, it's an advantage if you start playing classical music earlier, and it becomes your soul, if you like. Now, my father had a fantastic collection of old 78 RPM records of Andrés Segovia and some others, and that's the music we heard at home. Yeah. I mean, that and Rubinstein and other, you know, classical music was really his strongest love. And well, his mom's, I think. So at home, that was the music that was on all the time. And I grew up with that from the beginning. And so, you know, when I'm in my car, I don't put on pop music, or I don't put on jazz. I have classical music. It satisfies me completely, because that's really what I started with. Whether it's better or worse, I think it is an advantage to grow up in that field. Because, for example, most of the good classical players could learn the notes to play a flamenco piece. But you have to live the life, or you have to live and be part of that music to really believe it. So it's not just a matter of plucking the notes. And I think in classical music as well, you know, you can simply learn to pluck the notes, as many flamenco players have done. But they can't give it the same life as somebody who believes it completely, like a classical player should.
That's a great point. And someone who's not a player of any kind might not appreciate the distinction. I remember the first time I heard Carlos Montoya play, and I thought, this is a whole different thing. And mm-hmm. I was quite young. When we were, you're just a little bit older than I think. When we were growing up, there were some great players.
Absolutely, yes.
But my gosh, there's a lot of great guitar players around now.
Yeah, the things have really got much better for the in terms of the amount of really good players. And, you know, I travel around, I see lots of students. I'm seeing people that are just fabulous. Way, you know, the level is way above where it was when I was 18. You know?
But when you're young, your dad must have been remarkable, or something happened. Some switch must have gone off in your head, because you start winning competition after competition. You know, you get the blessing of the great artists, and your first records. Was your first label GHA?
No,
or GSP was it called?
No, GHA. You're right. Okay. It was GHA. GSP is a company in San Francisco. GHA is Guitar de Hier. From yesterday and today, and they are still there, you know. But these are companies that we started before CDs came out, you know, and making vinyl records and things. My first record was this. I went to Canada to play a tour in 1976. That was the first time I played in the States as well, and. My friend, who was my manager there, said, "Hey, we got to make a record, you know, because the other guys have LPs, you know, and we don't. I don't." So on the next tour, he organized all these concerts in schools and things. You know, so I was playing every single day, and then in the afternoon I'd go and record one piece at this place. Everything was a kind of, we were all beginners at it. The producer, everybody, the recording engineer had never done classical music, but it came out pretty well, and that LP has basically, it's disappeared. I mean, it's still, I have one or two copies, but that's about it. And that whole thing started that my friend Paul just said to a pupil of his who was a doctor, said, "How much do you charge for an operation?" And he said, "Well, so much." He said, "Well, one operation and you can be a record producer and you can even own the company." So he got this man to basically to sponsor the whole thing. In one go. So one operation, and I won't tell you what operations he did. And I had my first LP.
Wow. Yeah. You've been recording for Telarc.
Mm-hmm.
And Telarc's one of those labels that guitarists and sound guys always admire, because you get to find out the mics that are used. There's usually some indication somewhere you can find how we placed the mics when we did David Russell's latest album. How are they to work with?
Fantastic. You know, they're all originally classical music lovers, and I've made maybe 18 CDs with them over the years. Of course, the staff has changed, but I've been able to make at least the last 10 or 12, I can't remember, with the same engineer. So Tom Nabb has been my guy right from almost the first one, not the first, but still. It's meant that, the relationship that you have with your engineer and your producer, it's really important, because when you sit in a, I don't do it in a, it's not a studio recording, it's in a hall, but the hall is completely empty. They are your audience, you know. And in some ways, when you try to play well, it's sort of, you're trying to play well for them. And so that connection is really important. The other thing is just getting the sound. You know, when you go into a new place with a new engineer, the new mics, I think, you maybe waste a whole day. I won't say waste, but it takes a whole day just before you start to be happy with what's happening. With Tom, we can get in, you know, he sets it up, and in 10 minutes, we've decided, okay? You know, every year he brings a few more mics, and I want to try this, but we can always go exactly back to what we had the year before, or we can go back, say, the Bach CD, we like that one very much, so we can set it up with that, and is this going to be good for this repertoire? You know, it means that I can go from warm-up to recording without having to do all that playing where you're just banging away and then you go and listen to it. Is it good enough? Is it not? It's hard, you know. And when the amount of time you have to record sometimes quite restricted, then it's great to spend all of that time recording.
I don't want to get too far away, because I want to make sure we get to the things about this week, but mm-hmm. there's a recording of the Rodrigo Concerti that you, two of them that you did. And you
three.
Did it with...
There are three concertos.
Okay.
That's right. That's okay.
And that was for Telarc. That was with Naples Philharmonic.
Yes.
And Eric Kunzel, who's gone
yes,
now. What was he like to work with?
Oh, it's fantastic. You know, he's strange because he'd done an awful lot of the pops, classical pops and things, but he was incredibly efficient. You know, he really knew how to drive that orchestra and get the best out of them in the least amount of time we had. You know, we really had very short time to make the recording. And he is just, well, he's a motor, and he just got people to do their best incredibly well. It was really great. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it was almost intimidating, you know, just to see how much energy that man had. And I think it would have been very difficult to record the three concerti in a day and a half. So it's like 3 hours per concerto to actually get it down, you know. And then the last day, we had to also perform them, right? But Eric couldn't be there, right? So he had his understudy who sat in the recording in the sessions, and just to see how I was going to do it. And then that night he got out and conducted it. Fantastic.
Wow.
But it was a pretty stressful 2 days.
The Alnwith Concerto is sometimes touted as the one that got the guitar back in the concert hall, where Rodrigo said, you know, we're going to get the balance right between this orchestra that will reduce the number, but we've still got an acoustic instrument that's sitting out front that somebody's plucking on. Hmm. The other concerto, and I probably shouldn't take the question. I will. It was one of those wake-up calls, too, when I, you know, having grown up playing the violin, and then when I went to buy the Fantasia for Del Hombre, and they didn't have it in stock, so I got the piano reduction with the guitar. And I'm a kid, and the thing was, I don't know, $45, because the copyright was still in effect. It was one of those times you realize, Rodrigo's still with it. At the time, he was still with us. These are pieces that aren't that old.
That's right.
How do you feel about, I've asked other guitar players how they feel about that, the Fantasy. As a piece itself. Yeah.
Well, it's perhaps not such a well-written or great piece as the Concierto de Aranjuez, really. I think especially the first and second movement, is exceptionally well-written. I think that was some of Rodrigo's best writing. The Fantasia he did for Andrés Segovia some years after. Segovia asked him to do something, and the gentleman, Fantasia para un gentil hombre, is really Andrés Segovia, you know, and he was writing it for him. And I think he decided to write something that was more sparse, easier to put together. He used Gaspar Sanz, he used early Spanish music as the basis of the dances. I think it's a beautiful piece. I mean, it works really well. And I've played it with good orchestras and amateur orchestras. And usually it's possible to put it together. It's really funny because Rodrigo sometimes, he'd write, even on his solo works, sometimes they're relatively easy, and then, bang, he's got five bars there that, wow, they're so difficult. And with the orchestra in the Fantasia, the same thing happens. You know, that you can almost play, almost any orchestra can do it, but then they're like this one little bit that the trumpets have to be really good, and if not, it's a disaster. And then there's one little bit that if the violinist can't put it together, that little bit is like, ah! You know, so it's really strange. I sometimes think we could just change those little bits, but of course you wouldn't get the same result, you know.
I always feel bad for the high winds because they'll be asked to come in at pianissimo, you know, like in the stratosphere.
Yes.
if you don't have the chops for that, it's going
to
hurt.
Mind you, I think just to add to that, when Rodrigo was writing that especially, I think he wanted to try to improve the problem of balance. Mm. You know, that the Aranjuez has a fuller orchestra and much fuller orchestration, so the guitar sometimes has trouble getting through when you have no amplification. And in Rodrigo's time, when he wrote that in like end of the 30s, the Aranjuez, the Gentil Hombre, he really worked much harder at getting a balance that can work without amplification, and it's easier to play without amplification. Nowadays, the amplification is so much better than anything that Rodrigo ever heard. And so, you know, when we hear a CD, for example, the balance is, of course, tweaked, you know, so that the guitar doesn't, you don't have to hit it so hard, you can make your beautiful sound, and you get a good balance with the orchestra. Well, now you can do that with speakers and good mics and things. So I think that problem that Rodrigo saw in his first, in the Aranjuez, no longer really exists. if you're set up properly.
The guitar players have this terrible habit of collecting instruments. I don't know of another kind of my wife does not know why I need so many guitars. I've got two fiddles, but you've got a closet full of instruments. How many guitars do you own?
Well, Maria is laughing. She's saying too many. She's right. Is it kleptomania? You know, we just want them. You know, the thing is, an instrument is never complete. It's never perfect. There are always certain notes, certain areas that another one sounds better, you know. And it's very hard to find something that will really do everything for you. And even, you know, if you're in a sad mood, one instrument is going to work better than the other one, which is maybe a bright and happy guitar. You know, I don't want that today. But, you know, once you go on tour, you really have to say, okay, I'm going to take this one. And so I've been using guitars by a man called Matthias Dammann from Germany, and he makes fantastic instruments. And for 10 years, I used one, which there's a whole lot of reasons that eventually you say, this is the one I'm going to use. One of the reasons is, for example, here it's really dry. So you need an instrument that's not going to crack up, that's not going to suddenly sound bad when it gets super dry, or if you go to a very humid area, it's not going to suddenly sound like you know, wet towels. So, you know, you have a kind of practicality point of view. And I have one or two instruments at home that really sound great, but, you know, when I travelled with them, they sometimes sounded awful. And it's kind of depressing when you arrive to your concert hall, which is very often very dry because of the air conditioning systems. I mean, obviously, in Arizona, everybody knows that it's always going to be dry, but, you know, you go to Boston or something, you don't really expect it, or I didn't expect it, but then you arrive there. Because of the cold and the air conditioning, I think, and the guitar just sounded so bad. And it's whereas this one, and I now have a new one by Matthias, it's a fantastic guitar, really wonderful. So I'm now really happy. So Maria's suggesting maybe we should get rid of all the other ones. No, that's okay.
Have you got a ballpark? How many do you have?
Oh, there's probably 15 upstairs. And there's
Are they all nylon? Are they all?
Yes. I've got one or two that have like internal amplification and things, you know, but they don't really work that well. I prefer to use an external microphone. But they're all nylon. Yeah, they're all. One, two, three of them are kind of old style instruments, that is 19th century. One is a copy of a 19th century, so it's really beautiful. I don't play in that style so much. I mean, I prefer to play on my guitar. But still, it's nice sometimes to pick it up and play Giuliani on a guitar that would have been, well, a little bit after him. Especially Tárrega, for example. You can play on those instruments. It's a lot quieter, but much sweeter. You know? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's fun to do that. But they're all nylon. I don't have an electric guitar.
Now, I was even thinking about, you know, a flat top, you know, dreadnought. I just steel strings never touch those hands.
Well, you know, we've got all these fingernail things, you know, that steel strings, they chew through your fingernails. I mean, you know, we have to be so careful, unfortunately. This is a part of our voice. It's like our voice cord, really. So, you know, our fingernails, if I scratch them or something, it really changes the sound.